Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next episode of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Shayna Small. And kind of a cool little story is that she was actually like one of the very first podcasts that I ever did. And I did it in Charlotte, North Carolina, where she's located. And it was really cool. Like we had this great conversation, but the audio did not turn out correct. And so I thought I'd bring her back on the show because we have a lot of important things to talk about. She runs a Mysore program. She's a big influence in the Ashtanga community, and I'm just really grateful to have her on the show. So Shayna, thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, we always got to start with background, because I think it helps people relate to you. So I was wondering, can you give us a little bit of background of, who you were or who you are, today?
So I'm Shayna Small. I am an Ashtanga teacher in Charlotte, North Carolina. I've been practicing Ashtanga for about 20 years, and I've close to 20 years. I've been teaching for close to 15. I was born and raised in Alabama, and have pretty much lived in the South my whole entire life. And my love right now is finding the intersection between social justice and yoga. Just taking a look at the yoga community and seeing ways where we have lost people due to not being inclusive, due to not being accessible, and also looking at ways that we have neglected the study of the deeper parts of yoga or the other parts of yoga. And then like bringing them back out and seeing if I can find a way to make them accessible and make things doable and learnable for people, for the modern yoga student.
Sure. Well, how do you think Alabama, shaped the person that you are? Because all of the stuff that you just mentioned, a lot of the stuff happened in Alabama, civil rights movements, things like that. And so how do you feel like that shaped you? When you were a kid?
So with Alabama, the biggest thing that shaped me in Alabama was my family and my community, which put me kind of in a bubble. I was raised Pentecostal, very strict Pentecostal, like go to church almost every day type of Pentecostal, be at church all day type of Pentecostal, not wearing makeup, not wearing pants. I started wearing pants when I was in junior high school because I joined the marching band. And so the outfit, wow, pants, and then I started wearing pants then, not wearing makeup, not listening to secular music, and always just being in church all the time.
You were definitely in the bubble.
I was insulated a lot, but it was beautiful. My family was very close, is very close. My community was very close. So I was very insulated while I was in Alabama. Things happened, but because I was so insulated and in a Black community for the most part, of course, I went to school with people who were not Black, but because I was insulated so much, I experienced things, but not in the way people think. Like a lot of times when people are thinking about Alabama and places like that, they tend to think of like KKK wearing hats and cross burnings and people just shouting out the N-word and all of that type of thing. The way my life went is more of the subtle things that make up systemic oppression. And it's those things that are hard for people to wrap their minds around. And it's one of the reasons why we are having such problems today. Like things were so outright, during the civil rights movement. And now they're not as outright. And so because they're not, people don't know how to wrap their minds around them. So with me in my life, I had a great childhood in Alabama because I was so insulated and had such a close family. And for me, it was more subtle things that was going on. But yeah, I mean, I was glad to get out of Alabama because of it was so close knit that I felt like I couldn't fully really be who I am, especially in a family that's Pentecostal and very strict. Yeah. So though I love my family and I had a great childhood, it was definitely time for me to leave and to flower. But it wasn't because of like, you know, something horrible or anything like that happened. I just needed to grow. Like everything in my life has been about growth, and I've been blessed that I listen. You know, there's been periods of time where I don't haven't listened, but I listen to what my life is trying to teach me and what it's trying to tell me, and I make jumps and strides when I need to. So it was lovely, but it was time for me to go. And so, you know, I wind up in Charlotte by way of my husband.
Awesome. Well, so you talked about marching band. And so was that like kind of one of your first loves? Like, I mean, is something that you fell into, like something you were passionate about? Like how did you get into the marching band? Because it's pretty, a marching band's pretty serious.
Because I was a part of a Pentecostal church. So it's like a fire, brimstone, shouting, speaking in tongues type of, you know, guitars and piano, like Sunday service is like, you know, the club for us. I mean, there was like dancing and all this stuff going on. So I wanted to learn how to play an instrument because my thing was like, okay, I can play this at the church and be a part of the church. So I took up the trumpet in seventh grade and I played the trumpet all the way until 11th grade. I was in the marching band all the way up to 11th grade. And then I stopped because my band teacher, I wanted to be in symphonic band, which was like the highest band. And he was like, well, I need somebody strong in the band that was underneath that and in the marching band. And I was like, no, I don't want to march anymore. I don't want to do that. You know what I've done? Quit. But yeah, that's why I started, is because I just wanted to, you know, give back to my church community and play the trumpet, which I didn't do much of, but that was where that's where my thoughts were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's pretty, pretty amazing that, you know, like you felt sort of drawn to, you know, music, you know, and also that you wanted to give it back. I feel like that's, you know, pretty awesome. So, how did you make it to North Carolina? Like you said, like your husband, basically, you know, you guys moved there, or was he there already?
So I was in Alabama and I graduated from high school in Alabama. And then the first college I went to, I got a full ride to a little college that was in the city called, you can call it a city, I don't know if it really is, called Montgomery, Alabama. So I was in Montgomery, Alabama for like the first like semester of college. And I was like, this is still too small. This is still too close to home. And I want to learn and I want to grow. And I remember traveling to Atlanta when I was a girl to go to Six Flags with the church. We would take like a trip every year and we went to Six Flags and I loved Atlanta. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna transfer out of Charlotte to a college in Atlanta. So I went to Georgia State in Atlanta. And while I was attending college in Atlanta, that's when I met my husband. And we've been together, I mean, we've been together for about 21 years. So like we met like right when I like, basically right when I started college and have been together since then. And so we were in Atlanta for a long time and that's where I started practicing Ashtanga. And then he got a job in Charlotte. So I followed him up to Charlotte. And so we've been here for probably about over 10 years, probably about 12 years. I'm showing my age with these stories, but yeah. about 12 years. Yeah.
And so how did you get introduced to Ashtanga yoga? I'm interested in you know, how you kind of came to this style of yoga.
So I, you know, heard about yoga. Everybody, you know, yoga had started to become a trend at the time when I heard about it. And so I heard about this thing where you had spirituality mixed with quote unquote, a workout, right? So I heard about this thing and I was like, that sounds right up my alley. You know, coming from a Pentecostal background, I am still a very spiritual person, though I'm not Pentecostal, but I have had, you know, that type of Baba in my life for so long that, you know, I'm drawn to anything that has any type of spirituality to it. So I started taking some classes at a gym. It was just some local little gym. It was just a class called yoga. And I absolutely loved it. And then that particular teacher was moving. And so I was like lost. I was like, I need to find something else to get into. And so I was going to college at the time, and my rhetoric professor was an Iyengar teacher. He was talking about it one day, and I was like, boom, here we are. He was actually certified by BKS Iyengar and the Iyengar family before, you know, he died, and he was, you know, up in Pune and all of that. So he was big time.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so he was an Iyengar teacher. And so I went up to him afterwards. I was like, hey, you know, I'm looking for a new place to practice yoga. The woman that was teaching at the gym, she's gone. And should I practice Iyengar yoga? And he looked at me, he said, no. I was like, he's like, no, you should not practice.
I think he was correct too. I think he was right.
I think he was right too. He's like, no, you should not. He was like, go practice Ashtanga yoga. He said, I think at your age, with your energy level, that Ashtanga yoga would be better for you. And, you know, he told me about a studio to go to, and that studio is no longer, I don't think it's no longer teaching just Ashtanga, but at the time it did. And so he told me about that studio, and then the rest was history. I mean, I walked up in there and I loved it. The community was beautiful. It was a lead class. The community was beautiful. I could feel the energy of the place, the spirituality around it. I love the idea that there are all these people doing stuff that was absolutely outrageous. Like for me, when I see stuff like that, I get excited, which I know is not what happens to a lot of people. And that's why I started teaching more accessible classes. But for me, when I walked in there and saw people doing absolute crazy stuff, I'm like, wow, I want to learn how to do that. That's super cool. You know, and
I think the normal person is like, they got their leg behind their head. It's not supposed to be behind their head.
I know. And for me, I was like, oh my God, this is so fun. And I was hooked. I mean, I did Ashtanga only for probably the first five years. Probably. And the only reason I started doing other styles was because when I moved, I didn't have a studio to go to. So then I started kind of like seeing what was going on in everybody else's house. But honestly, probably if I would have stayed in Atlanta, I would probably have never experienced anything else. And obviously it wasn't meant. But I absolutely loved Ashtanga right from the beginning, had no desire to do anything else, and absolutely loved the community.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how did you get into teaching? Like how did that process happen?
So when I moved to Charlotte, there was no solid Ashtanga community. So after the fact, I learned that over the years, people had tried to get one going, but no one was ever able to get one going and to get it continuously going and to like get the community to grow. And so when I moved there, there was no place. There was nowhere to go and practice Ashtanga. There just wasn't. So I was like, well, I want to be able to do this. And the studios in Charlotte at the time, in order to teach at these studios, you had to be RYT 200. So I was like, okay. So I went and did a teacher training so that I could have the RYT 200. And so that I could start teaching within people's studios. But honestly, the only reason I started teaching Ashtanga was because there was no one else doing it. And I love Ashtanga and I wanted to build a community, and there was no one else doing it at the time. So I, you know, I did the little teacher training, learned a little bit from that, and then put that together with, you know, the 5 years. And it's not a lot, but like I said, at the time there just was no one else. And I just felt this need to provide or to help the few teachers that were trying time to time to start things in Charlotte. So yeah. I started to teach it just for that reason, just to like get something that I love and see if I could help grow it and be of service in any type of way.
Yeah, it's been pretty cool. Like I've been able to come down there and teach a few workshops, and it is a great community of people. Like, I mean, you know, some of like people who are dear to me, like are down there, who are students of mine, are down in Charlotte. And so, yeah, you know, it is a beautiful community. And, you know, from the very beginning, when I first went down there, like I mean, I heard about you. Like, I also saw what you were doing on social media with, I think at the time it was a Stronga Picture Project, mm-hmm. and like, you know, doing the work and, you know, putting your videos out there. And I was grateful that I got to meet you because like, I kind of saw the fruits of your, or the, you know, the fruits of your labor to a certain degree, which is cool.
Oh yeah. You know, people really work hard or were trying to work hard. You know, there's Fauna. I'm going to say some names because these are great teachers in the Charlotte community that I am thankful for and that are really doing good work trying to build strong communities. There's Fauna Moore. There's Jonna Smith. There's ML. There's Stewart. I mean, just so many. Lisa Tendler. Amazing teachers here that are just really trying to get the word out. And I'm so thankful for them and that I met them and to be a part of their community.
Yeah. And so now there's a bunch of you. It's not just you.
Yeah, but it's still interesting. Charlotte is interesting. Charlotte is a hot power yoga city. And it is hard to get anybody. It is, people are like addicted to it. So it's kind of, it's a hard sell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, like Columbus has a, you know, a pretty much what I would say like a sort of power vinyasa, you know, kind of background. And we do pretty well here, you know, in Columbus. It's, you know, it's pretty awesome to see something that you put a bunch of effort into and you get good teachers and you see like people like taking on to the practice. You know, what I've realized is that it's not about the number of people in the community. It's really about the quality of the practitioner, mm-hmm. you know, that's coming in there. And that's really been like pretty amazing thing. It's like, I don't want 100, you know, bad students, or I'll call them bad students. They wouldn't be bad students, but I don't want 100 students that, you know, just show up one day a week. I'd take 25 that show up every single day, mm-hmm. you know, I'd take 50 that show up every day, you know, or 4 days a week or five, mm-hmm. whatever it is. But you know, so I've been blessed in that. And you know, you've really, I mean, I've kind of seen the growth that has happened in Charlotte. And it's been pretty amazing. Yeah. You know, so it's really awesome. So let's talk a little bit about kind of the current circumstances of like what is going down, not only in the United States, but, you know, some of the stuff that you've been putting out on social media has definitely got me thinking for sure. And so let's talk a little bit about like, you know, the social justice, how it plays into Ashtanga yoga or how it plays into maybe the community as a whole with yoga and like some of your experiences with that.
So yoga, the yoga came from South Asia, right? Let's just say that. And some people feel like it has its roots in Africa. So whether or not you believe it's Africa, whether or not you believe its roots are in South Asia, its roots definitely are not in a white culture. We can all agree that it's not there. And, right. But yet when you look at the yoga world, it is dominated by white people. The students is primarily white, affluent females. The teachers that you see, even though there are black teachers, their voices are not uplifted, but the teachers you see are mostly white. The body types that are worshipped as being beautiful and that has beautiful poses are mainly white. And it is so strange and so crazy that this has happened to something that didn't even come from here. And it happened so fast. Like when I first started teaching or first started practicing yoga, it was very much understood that you give homage to the culture this came from and that there's certain elements that have to be included and that go with it. And it was like over time, these just kept getting erased. And when they get erased, you erase, you know, whole groups of people. And then you have whole groups of people who just don't feel comfortable anymore being a part of yoga, which sucks because yoga is this amazing thing that brings peace and happiness and changes the world and is glorious. And everyone should have access to it or everyone should feel comfortable doing it. But yet they don't. And so with me, I got to a point where I couldn't take it anymore. Like, I started in the yoga world and I was told by well-meaning white people that, you know, if I teach it this way, that eventually, which is the way that they wanted me to teach it, which was very set in this type of white type of thing, supremacy culture type of thing. If I taught it in this particular way, that eventually I would be able to teach it in another way. But first, I needed to teach it this way. I needed to build my classes. I needed to get these people. And these people would want to hear then what I had to say about other things. And it never happened. It never happened. I just saw myself. I just lost more and more of myself every single year that I taught. People that were coming to my class, because the whole, you know, system is set up on this, you know, well, you know, this is our market, which is, you know, white, affluent, privileged people, that, so this is our market. And so everything has to be geared towards them. And I never, ever was able to bring my voice forward. And yeah. Very afraid to bring my voice forward. And then I started listening to other people in the community, like Black people that were like, I'm tired of what's going on here. And then South Asian people that were like, I'm tired of what's going on here. What happened? And I was like, I can't do this anymore. I've got to figure out a way to take what I love, something that has really changed my life and that I live, eat, and breathe yoga, I love it, and make it accessible to people, to make people understand that we have not forgotten about you. I honor the South Asian culture, where this came from, and the beauty of it, and also the beauty of the Black community, and everyone who wants to be a part of this, they should be able to. So I got to a point where I was like, I can't, like people say, it's not enough to be like, you know, non-racist, you got to be anti-racist. And not that Black people can be racist, but it was this idea that it's not enough to see it, that I've got to actually act. I can't sit here and say, well, I don't like what's going on in the yoga community and what it looks like, and then keep doing things that perpetuate it, never, ever changing. That I've actually got to make active steps to actually change the community or help facilitate it or facilitate conversations that sure. Maybe open people's eyes up to the fact that, yeah,
and excuse my ignorance. I mean, because I'm trying to listen, trying to learn all that stuff, but I'm wondering if those first questions or those first kind of things that, those people were saying to you, like, this is our market. Was it capitalism? And then the capitalism had like this undertone of racism, because, and is that what you're saying? Or is it actually that it was just racist and it didn't give you the opportunity to like share your voice or to find those people that would connect with you?
Good question. So the society that we're in right now was built on white supremacy. It was built on, if you're in the West, I'm not going to speak for other people's other areas, even though I know other areas have their own stories of things that happen. And I'm versed on some things, but not a lot. But when we look at the West, this society that we have right now was built on the backs of Black and brown people like 400 years ago. And it was built through the genocide of people 400 years ago and earlier than that. It's built on the genocide of the Native American. It's just the whole way the system is set up. It was built on blood and tears and rape and theft. And so because of this, this stuff is still, it's like it's in the soil, and it's like you can like build a pretty house on top of it. But like it's in the soil, it's still underneath, it's still there, and it's still seeping out, and it seeps into how people think and how they feel and how they go about their day in ways that they are not even aware that is seeping out and seeping in. So a lot of times people are like, yeah, it's just capitalism. This is the market. And, you know, this is what I'm, you know, and I need to pay my bills, and this is what I'm going towards. That's one way to look at it. But the thing is, what you don't change stays the same. So at one point, the market was slavery. It was slavery. people had slaves, and slaves were, you know, out in the field, and, you know, they were working, and bad stuff was happening to my people. And, you know, people were totally okay with that continuing, right? But it just came to a head where people were like, no, we're not going to do this. You had, you know, the abolitionists, you had the Underground Railroad, you had all this stuff start to happen and laws start to pass. And it got to a point where just, you know, it came to a head and we were able to change that. So a lot of things that are not really working for different groups of people are done in the name of capitalism and done in the name of making money. So at some point, and especially if a person is choosing to be a yogi, you know, part of yoga, number one, is looking at our thoughts. And then number two, a part of yoga is, you know, non-harming, meaning we're doing the least amount of harm possible. So if we're out here and we see that there's a whole group of people that is benefiting from the way the system and the society is set up now, and then there's a whole group of people that is not benefiting and actually maybe dying because of the way the system is set up. As a yogi, it's like, it's not enough to be like, well, you know, sorry, I'm benefiting. This is the way it is, which is what I was told, you know, in many of the yoga studios that I worked at. This is the way it is. This is how it is. And yeah, it'll stay that way forever. And as long as you are benefiting from it, you won't want to change it, right? While there's a whole other group of people over here that is not benefiting from it being this way. So,
and also that and you're saying like, that's a population that also needs it, but doesn't have basically access to it because the studios aren't focused on growing that at all.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, if you were advising someone who is starting a program that is trying to open up the doors to the change that you're talking about, like, what kind of things, is it just making it accessible to them? Or is it the how we're doing on, like, what we're saying on social media? Like, I mean, what makes it so that all of a sudden it is not about capitalism and it's about being anti-racist and providing access to yoga to, you know, underserved, you know, populations, like what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so like, what are we supposed to do as studio owners in order to open up that door? Because what you're saying is that it's closed. And that kind of pisses me off. And the reason why it pisses me off is because in a certain sense, I'm a minority too. Like in the fact that I'm an addict, like I started my business, like there's addicts at my place. Like, you know, it's like addicts are dying all the time. And so it's like, I provide access to the struggling alcoholic and drug addict, but it's like, it kind of pisses me off to hear you say that because like, I don't want another population to go unheard or talked about or marketed to. So tell me what you would have someone in my position or in your position, like what things that you've done to open up that door so that it feels more inclusive and accessible to people, you know, people of color.
That's a good question. So when we talk about anti-racism, the most important thing about it is that it has to be active. Because we're at a point where it's like, if it's not active, it's not going to change because everything is moving. The direction everything is moving is not moving towards anti-racism. So in order for the law is anything in motion will stay in motion unless acted on by an outside force. So we're at a point where the way the world is working is going to stay in motion because it's working for a huge group of people who happen to hold power. So in order for that to shift, we are going to have to be actively involved in helping that to shift. So what I feel that a lot of people need to do is they need to look at, and it's very difficult when you're so involved in it, but we have to look at ways in which we send signals that you are or are not welcome at a yoga studio. And it's small things that people don't really think about too much. You know, the big, you know, something that people talk about all the time is your images, you know, the images on your websites and the images that you place on Instagram, all of that. Those images shouldn't be fake, right? If you have to ask Black and brown people to show up on picture day to make sure that you have inclusive and diverse pictures, that means that your studio is not inclusive and diverse. Okay. So it's looking at stuff like that, like, okay, that sends a signal. Okay. My studio is not inclusive. It's not diverse. And if it is, you know, show it, make sure people know, hey, our studio is inclusive and it's diverse. But if it's not, don't put up some fake, you know, pictures for people to see that. But that's one thing. Representation, your teachers. Are there teachers there that are of color at the studio? And if not, why? And you know, this, you know, no one has to answer this question out loud, but why? And take a look at it. Why is that not happening? How could it start to happen? People need to see people that look like them if they're going to come to the studio. So then, if no one there is black or brown, then why? Taking a look at that. Another thing, you know, a lot of yoga studios play music. So like, what is the type of music that's played, you know, within the classes? You know, are there black and brown voices? Or is it just, you know, all, you know, white voices singing? It's like, you know, this isn't for me. It's little things we do. The sizing of the clothes.
Yeah.
Studio. Yeah. Are they all extra, extra small? Our approach to teaching. Are we making everybody's poses look like something that, you know, a size, you know, 4 person would be able to do? For instance, Marichi D. You know, are we like trying to force people whose bodies are a little curvier into poses that their curvy bodies are, you know, may not be accessible for them? And are we making them feel bad? Are we making them have to stay in Marichi D until they lose weight? Are we doing things like that? Like those types of things send messages. Who is this place for? Oh, this teacher's making me, you know, I like my ass, but this teacher's making me lose weight, or trying to get me to lose weight to be a Marichi D, even though I've got this curvy body. Who is this for? Like, all this stuff sends signals. So yoga studios have to take a look at what signals are they sending out.
That makes a lot of sense. And you know, over the last, I would say a couple of years, I feel like we've been more and more conscious about that as we presented ourselves on social media. You know, but the only problem with social media is that, like, I don't like to do things that feel fake. So I'm not going to ask, you know, black people to show up to my class just so I can take a picture of them. That feels gross to me. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're there, you know, and they're willing to get their picture taken, I'll have that happen. But like, we've tried to kind of push the envelope. You know, I'm just wondering if there's things that, you know, that, I mean, let me just ask you point blank. Is it intimidating for a black person to walk into a class of only white people?
For a lot of black people, it's not intimidating. It just doesn't feel like you belong. You just don't feel like you belong, and that you'll be understood. Because as a black person, all your life, for a lot of black people, I can't speak for every black person on the planet, but for a lot of people, all your life, you have had to endure little microaggressions, little things that people, like, you know, for instance, a microaggression would be like somebody trying to touch your hair, asking you, whenever I take my grandbaby out, who's very light, I get all these questions from people about his skin color and his hair color and all this stuff. Like, those are things that black people tend to have to deal with whenever they're in a group with a whole bunch of white people. So it's like, you know, they walk in your studio and that is kind of there. It's like, uh-oh, you know, this is a place where am I going to really be able to be comfortable and be me? Will people understand? Am I always going to have to be explaining myself? And a yoga studio is a place where you're supposed to be able to relax, relatively speaking. We know yoga is not, you know, something you relax in, but meaning relax mentally, meaning you're not worried that somebody is just going to be saying crazy stuff to you and doing crazy things.
I understand. Yeah.
After you walk through a room full of white people, it's like, you know, with black people, you just don't know what you're going to get. And it's like, sometimes you're like, you know what, I don't have time for this. And you know, then if the micro little aggressions do happen, the studio owners have no understanding of it. And you're eventually like, you know what, this is not a place where I want to be. And so maybe you come once or twice and you don't come back. And that's what happens with a lot of studios that have a lot of white people. You're like, well, we have black people come, but why don't they stay? Why don't they?
Gotcha. Yeah, and you know, it's just very interesting, you know, because even though that I feel like this is something that me and my social media person has worked on, it just for some reason it, you know, like people, like we have a lot of Indian students, we don't have a lot of Black students, we have some Asian students as well, you know, but it's something that is constantly like. Thing that we're working on to be more inclusive to LGBT, you know, like all, like really all these communities that aren't sort of spoken for, we're trying to open up the doors for them. So those are good. Those are great insights. But my other question to you is, like, how did you stay? Like, how did you stay? I mean, you know, because I'm assuming that when you walked into your first Ashtanga class, it was a group of white people. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. And like, how did you stay? Like, how did you fit in? And why did you stay? If like what you're saying is like your brothers and sisters are feeling uncomfortable about it, like what kept you there?
So my first Ashtanga experience was in Atlanta, and Atlanta is, when I was there, it was like predominantly Black. So it was like, Atlanta has a really big Black community there. I stayed because my love of Ashtanga yoga, and I already was very supported at the time by the Black community. And so I stayed because of my love of Ashtanga yoga. And as a Black person living in America, you learn how to cope with being around white people. Like, really, when you hear people talk about how they have to like train their children how to be around white people, what to do when you get stopped by cops, what to do when this happens when you're with white people, like we all get that training, and I got that training as a Black child. So you learn how to basically like quiet down parts of yourself. Like the first job I ever had, they were like, oh, you do everything great. You're so great, Shane, about how come you don't smile enough? Like, what? They're like, oh, you need to smile more. You should smile more. You look like you're angry. You should smile more. And that happened another time at a yoga studio. They're like, you should smile more. I'm like, huh? All right. And so that's the stuff that white people, you have to smile a lot, because if you don't smile a lot, they feel threatened and they feel uncomfortable. So those are things you learn as a person growing up and as you're Black. So because I have the tools that I was taught by my family how to cope when I'm with in a group of white people. So I use those tools. But some people don't, especially now. It's like they're tired of coping. You're tired. Done that for years, waiting to, you know, get our seat at the table. Because I was taught in my family that if I was a good girl, I had good grades, I went to college, that I would get my seat at the table. And that's what a lot of people are taught. And then we saw that that was not the case. It was not happening. So like, we're tired of smiling. We're tired of having to present in a certain way when we're in a group of white people, though we are very used to it. I'm very used to it. But like, we're tired of having to do that, having to present in a certain way. And so I did for years in the yoga community. I presented in a certain way because I was told that if I presented in a certain way, I would have success. And I did have success. I had a big, you know, I had a good following at the studio that I worked at. I was one of the top tier teachers, but I wasn't myself. I wasn't me. Yeah. I don't want to be fake and be successful. I want to be me. So we get tired of having, as Black people, having to present a certain way in order to be safe, and so that white people feel safe, so that they're not doing anything to us. So yeah, I did that for years in the yoga community, but I just got to a point where I was like, I'm not doing it anymore, and no one else should have to do it.
Yeah, that sucks. I wouldn't want to do it either. So I totally can empathize with that, because it's just like, it's sort of, I mean, and I hate to even draw this comparison, but it's the first time I walked into a yoga studio and I felt like such an outsider. And part of the reason why is because I was living on the streets. I was addicted to heroin. And then all of a sudden, like, I come into this place and the studio's brand was like angelic. You know, they called the desk people that greeted you when you walk in, they called them desk goddesses. And I remember walking in the first time and I was like, oh, like shit, like I don't fit in here at all. And the reason why is because I was 6 months sober, 5 months sober, something like that, walking in there, and I was like, I got to like be careful in my behavior. I got to make sure I don't cuss. I got to make sure I wear the right things. Like, do not fart in class. Like, make sure you like eat the right things, you know, make sure that you don't, you're not smelly. Like, I went through the whole list, and you eventually reach a spot where you're like, this blow, like, this is terrible. You know, like, why would I want to do that? And so I can totally empathize with it for sure.
And yeah, you know, beautiful story. I mean, that's how we have to get that sensitive, like, even as yoga studio owners. Like, I remember when you came to one of the studios that I worked at in Charlotte to practice, and I was like, you know, because I knew you were from the recovery community, and like the first thing you see when you walk into that particular studio, at the time, there was like these wine racks on the side of do you remember?
I do remember. I was like, what are they doing? And I remember like walking in and, you know, like, seriously, bless their heart. But the, like, I remember hearing like poison. They were, like, in the other big room, there was like, I looked like 100 people in the other room, and they were playing Poison. I was like, where's the Mysore room at in this place? Yeah, there's wine racks. There's like,
And you know, and it takes like that type of like awareness, like, and that's what love is. It's like, you know, you walk, when you came in, I was like, you know, immediately conscious of you're here and I want you to feel totally comfortable. And I look over and there's like all this wine like stacked up. Like, I mean, I think that's how we have to be as yoga teachers and yoga studio owners. Like, you know, that was immediate. That was immediate for me. I was like, wow, damn. And yeah, you know, it has to be that way. Like, a Black student walks in and we're immediately like, damn, that, you know, picture of that white blonde girl right there on the wall. I wonder how they feel about that. And then they walk over to the clothing rack and we're like, damn, you know, all these clothes, you know, they're size zero. Like, damn, it's like, we have to be that, you know,
maybe that small to get into this yoga class. Jesus.
Yeah, we got to be that present with the people who walk in, you know, and be that considerate of them and try to make it so that they feel comfortable. Each and every person does.
Yeah. I'm wondering like how you feel like being Black has shifted like how you are in the yoga community. Do you feel like they're paid more attention to you? Like, and I'm talking more like not necessarily just Charlotte, like, you know, sort of more broadly, but you think they pay more attention to you, or do you feel like because you're Black, they pay less attention to you?
Absolutely not more attention.
Well, I mean, definitely right now, I feel like, and part of the reason why you're on the show, because I mean, you've really like been saying some compelling things that have got me listening, me thinking. You know, it's part of the reason why I'm asking these questions, so I can be informed and so other people can be informed, the people that are listening. And so, yeah, tell me about it. Like, you feel like now, your voice isn't heard?
Well, now my voice is being heard. And that's because now people are either ashamed or feel they got to do better. But it's because of George Floyd. It's because of Ahmaud Arbery. It's because of all the things that have been going on. I've been slammed over the last few months, but that's the last few months. Honestly, I absolutely feel that I absolutely have been overlooked. Like, for instance, I just did a few things for a couple of really big yoga companies, and some of my white teacher friends, they contacted me and they was like, yes, yeah, about time you finally got what you deserve. So even they knew here in Charlotte that I was not getting the same opportunities that white people who honestly hadn't even been teaching as long as me were getting. Yeah. There were people who were skinny, pretty affluent, coming out of teacher trainings that were getting opportunities that I had no access to. I still had people who would walk right by me when they came into the yoga studio and not greet me. And then I'd walk into class and they would be floored that I was their teacher. I still had people that were like, that for some reason they had, you know, I was subbing or something. And so they wind up in one of my classes and they'd be like, oh my God, you were absolutely great. How long have you been here? And in that particular place, I was like, yeah, I've been here almost since it opened. Which was like 10 years. And they like, So no, definitely me being Black did not make me stand out. It made me invisible, actually, for the longest time. And, you know, I have had people, especially in the Shanga community, who have tried their best to uplift me over the last few years that I've known. I'm not going to name any names right now, but they know who they are, but who have tried their best to put me on their huge platforms to uplift my voice, put me on, Shana can write these blogs, can be in my magazine. They've been out there. And then after these things happen, there's no phone calls. There's nobody inviting me to do anything, to go anywhere, to do anything. So I absolutely was invisible in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm not now only because of what's going on. And that's a shame and it's messed up. And it should not be that way. I'm the same person now that I was, you know, 3 or 4 months ago when nobody gave a damn about who me.
Yeah.
Same person.
Yeah, it's a shame for sure. I mean, especially, you know, you've been teaching for 20 years. I mean, I've got to witness you practice. I mean, you have an amazing practice, like a huge dedication. I feel like the stuff that you've been putting out, even before all of the stuff that is currently happening, has always been good stuff. Compelling articles and videos and things like that, I think have always been, they've been spot on. Like some of your blogs, I think, like, you know, the blogs that you wrote like a couple years ago, I was just like, man, she's like on point with this stuff right now. Yeah. And so you've done a really good job with it. And it's unfortunate that you're in that position. And, you know, a part of me putting you on here and, you know, trying to do my part, I guess, is to, you know, uplift your voice, give you a platform to talk about, and also say, like, you know, call out the BS, like it's BS, you know, you got 20 years experience, you've been to Mysore, you taught, you're teaching accessible. It's like, there should be opportunities for you for sure. For sure. So, and so where do we go from here? Like, what do you think, like, the biggest thing for maybe the Ashtanga community and also the yoga community in general? Where do you think we go from here? Like, how do we make sure that these things that we're talking about now, like, become lasting changes?
Don't stop doing the work. You can't stop doing the work. It's like, you know, it's in my Ashtanga practice. If I stop doing the work, then, you know, any things that I've seen happen in my yoga practice, you know, there's a risk of them not taking hold, not staying. So it's like, I constantly have to do the work. I am not enlightened. I am not awakened. And I know that if I don't get on my mat every single day and take a look at myself and my mind and my thoughts and how I am in this world, I know it's very easy for me to go back to sleep and to not grow and to not change. So I think we can't stop doing the work. It can never stop. So we have to constantly be looking at our yoga studio and asking ourselves, you know, how can this be more accessible? How can, you know, what is up with my community? You know, why is it all? Why? How can I get bring in more people? Like, it's got to be constantly be things that we're actively working on. And these are not easy questions. Like, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, it's going to be easy if you have a yoga studio that's not very diverse, that you're going to be able to change that by clicking your fingers the next day. But just constantly taking a look at it, jumping on opportunities when you see it to make things a little bit better for people, uplifting melanated voices. Even if you like feel like at a loss right now of what to do, you can still uplift melanated voices. You can still uplift people who are actually out there doing the work and who actually do have their stuff together and are making active changes and active solutions. You can uplift those people. You can invite those people to come to your studio and do talks. And you can invite those people to virtually do talks for you and you do things to get the information out there. So yeah, that's my thing is don't stop. Don't stop. Don't stop.
Yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your heart and speaking up and you know, sharing your story. It means a lot to me and I think a lot to my community. And so, Shana, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga yoga,
visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.